The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Exploring New Roots in Immuno-Oncology, Understanding the Role of Subcutaneous Immune Checkpoint Inhibitors, and Preparing for Innovative Delivery Approaches in the Clinic. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/GUE860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello, my name is Professor Laurence Albigès. I am a medical oncologist, head of the medical oncology department in Gustave Roussy Institute here in Paris in France. And welcome to this educational activity where I will be providing you with an understanding of how subcutaneous administration, sub-Q, of checkpoint inhibitors can address unmet needs in different cancer settings. I would also like to explain and augment your knowledge of the new clinical trials evidence in this setting, but also the ongoing studies with sub-Q immuno-oncology agents, and ultimately equip you with the real-world strategy that you and your care team can use to integrate sub-Q formulation in your practice based on these latest evidence, but also the patient preferences and also the impact for our healthcare system. So let's get started. The sub-Q administration in oncology is not new. It's been used for a while, and to be fully transparent, it actually started with heme oncology. Indeed, rituximab was the first sub-Q monoclonal antibody that was used in oncology, FDA approved for heme malignancies back in 2017. It has demonstrated a non-inferiority efficacy and similar safety and tolerability as IV counterparts. But interesting, it is also the preferred option for about 90% of patients in those very first studies. What is important, it was able to reduce the median infusion time, and that is something extremely meaningful as we will be discussing later. The second agent that has been approved with a sub-Q formulation by the FDA was trastuzumab, a very well-established HER2 targeting agent that we are using in breast cancer. What is coming now is other tumor type and PD-1 inhibitors. The first one this year, 2024, is atezolizumab, PD-L1 inhibitor that you're very familiar with that has been approved in Europe, a cross indication based on a phase 3 conducted in non-small cell lung cancer. And what we can say is that the sub-Q approach is important with two different aspects. The first one, it has clearly an impact for the patient, and we can stress the patient convenience. But it is also important in terms of impact for hospital and the way we organize care because of the administration time allocated with sub-Q, to some extent impacting our hospital availabilities, and also the perception of a less invasive administration route for our patient, coming back again to our patient convenience. What I would like to stress as well is that it is well established that immune checkpoint inhibitors are now used across many tumor types. It has been approved across many indications, but we do know that IV infusion is associated with some degree of treatment burden. The time that is allocated for that, meaning the need for within your infusion room for chair time, and to some extent as well, the risk of complication, the need of IV administration, but also the risk of potential infection or thrombosis that can be associated with the IV route. So ultimately, the sub-Q administration provides an alternative that can benefit both from the patient ends in terms of alleviating the need for IV vent ports, allowing more flexibility, reducing the time the patient would spend in the hospital, and therefore being perceived as a better quality of life. On the other hand, the impact for healthcare provider, meaning reducing the time for your pharmacist in terms of preparation, administration times in your infusion room, optimize the occupancy within your infusion centers, and therefore allowing to have a better use of your healthcare's resource, and in between, some points that are both positive for the patient and the care team, especially the decreased time for administration, as well as streamlining the process, that is very important. What we need to stress is that to be able to move from an IV administration to a sub-Q, it means that we have to be able to provide a high dose of drug within a volume that would be requesting a smaller volume to be administered with a sub-Q form. So that means that the immune checkpoint we will be using, administering, needs a co-formulation. And it needs a co-formulation with what we call a recombinant human hyaluronidase, PH20 enzyme. There has been different enzymes being tested. I'm going to at least expand this one, which permits the administration of a large volume of a co-formulated therapeutic agent, helping to improve the absorption and the dispersion of the drug when administered sub-Q with your AirHU PH20. And so it is important to stress that, of course, we have to change the volume. And by changing the volume, we need a co-formulation with a kind of hyaluronidase. So that being said, we've reviewed the rationale, the unmet needs, and how sub-Q checkpoint inhibition can improve and the patient care. But where do we stand in terms of data and the scope? And so there have been, and there are still ongoing, different phase 3 that are assessing the sub-Q route versus IV route. Two of them have already reported, and 3 are still ongoing. So I'm going to walk you through the 2 that have already reported. The very first one, as I mentioned earlier on the timeline, is atezolizumab, sub-Q versus IV. This is a non-small cell lung cancer phase 3. It started with a phase 1, basically defining the tolerability and the dose finding, and then went up to part 2, which is a non-inferiority randomized phase 3. And so patients were randomized 2-to-1 to either receive atezo sub-Q versus atezo IV. And so the co-primary endpoint was activity, and here I'm stressing progression-free survival as well as objective response. And what we can say is that there is a non-inferiority in terms of progression-free survival using the sub-Q administration. And to your right, the objective response rate is pretty similar, with even a little delta favoring the sub-Q route. So based on this result, sub-Q atezolizumab co-formulated with AirHU PH20 has been approved by Europe following this randomized phase 3. Now I'm going to move on to a second combination here, which is nivolumab plus AirHU PH20. And so here again, there's been a first part that was basically phase 1-2 and the CheckMate AKX study. Here, as a phase 1-2, the idea was to demonstrate that the combination was well tolerated with a safety profile consistent with nivolumab IV. And it also provided 2 main information. The mean injection time in this phase 1-2 was less than 5 minutes. And the second key information was about PK endpoint. Because what you want is to make sure that your patient get exposed properly to the nivolumab. And so the different sub-Q dose have been compared to what is standard of care in nivolumab when it was initially developed, 3 milligrams per kg every 2 weeks when administered IV. And to put a long story short, what we can see is that the sub-Q use did allow to have a proper exposure to nivolumab, and the dose that has been retained is the 1,200 milligram of nivolumab administered subcutaneously every 4 weeks. And so what I like in this study is that although it is a phase 1-2, the patient had the opportunity to express their preference. And within the study, they were asked, if you were given the choice, which route of administration would you prefer? And the pale yellow here on this slide is depicting the patient that were announcing that they would prefer sub-Q administration. Some of them did not have a preference, but we can clearly see that across the different groups that were screened within this phase 1-2, there was a strong voice in favor of sub-Q. So that led to a phase 3, and it's a non-inferiority design as well. That is a phase 3 CheckMate 67T, sub-Q nivolumab in patients with advanced or metastatic renal cell carcinoma. So the patient had to have metastatic RCC with clear cell component to match the approval of nivolumab single agent and previously failed one up to two prior systemic regimen. These are usually patients failing VEGF TKIs. The patients were randomized to either received one-to-one randomization, nivolumab sub-Q, 1200, plus the RHU-PH20 every 4 weeks, versus nivolumab IV, 3 milligrams per kg every 2 weeks to match the very first PK data we have with nivolumab IV. And the co-primary endpoint in studies are both pharmacokinetic endpoints assessed by both the average at day 20 serum concentration of nivolumab, as well as what is named the throw serum concentration at steady state. The scope primary endpoint was overall response rate, because once again here, what we want is to make sure that not only we're non-inferior in terms of PK endpoints, but also in terms of clinical endpoints. Because the bottom line is that you want your patient to be properly exposed to your agent, here nivolumab, but that has to be meaningful in terms of both efficacy, but also toxicity, so that you really move from the PK endpoint to the PD endpoint and get to your clinical response. So the study met the co-primary endpoints, meaning that it did demonstrate a non-inferiority of nivo sub-Q plus RHU-PH20 versus nivolumab IV. And not only it demonstrated a non-inferiority, but interestingly, it seemed that the exposure was actually higher with the nivo sub-Q. Now, moving on to clinical benefits, it's important because I'm a medical oncologist. So what I care about is, am I sure my patient derived the benefit I expect with nivolumab? And the answer is yes. If you look at the response rate with nivo IV, 18% is what we anticipate here, and actually 24.2% in the nivo sub-Q. So clearly not only a non-inferiority, but a trend toward better exposure. And I'm stressing here the response rate, but I'm going to draw your attention to the progression-free survival, which also showed not only a non-inferiority, but a trend towards a longer progression-free survival in the sub-Q arm. And notably, the time to response was the same across IV and sub-Q administration. So these curves depict the progression-free survival that was similar and numerically higher for the sub-Q arm. With regard to safety, and that is important, there was indeed some degree of local site reaction in the nivo sub-Q arm, but these were transient, and the mean duration of those local reactions were only 3 days. With regard to the treatment-related adverse events, they are actually extremely similar between IV and sub-Q, with no statistical difference, looking either at any grade toxicity as well as grade 3-4 toxicity, ranging in the same ballpark of about 10% for the grade 3-4 treatment-related adverse event, and no increased risk of a treatment discontinuation. I'd like to just say a few words on the fact that in this study was analyzed the occurrence of ADA. This is important because one of the questions would be the immunogenicity of using sub-Q administration. And despite the fact that there was a higher rate of ADA positivity within patients with sub-Q nivolumab, that did not translate in terms of safety, as I stressed, as well as any other anaphylactic reaction between the two arms. So what this study, 67T, is demonstrating is that sub-Q use clearly provide equipoise to standard IV use of nivolumab. And I believe that this has the potential to make the therapy more convenient and better tolerated for our patients. And indeed, the median administration time for subcutaneous nivolumab was less than 5 minutes versus 30 minutes for the IV route, as you know. So this has, to me, a potential impact across different indications. Of course, pending the fact that this study would lead to an approval, I would like to stress that to me, if a patient requires a treatment, I do like to discuss with the patient what is convenient to him, to her. And so, if available, I will be discussing the use of subcutaneous administration. Is there a limitation in type of patient? Is there a limitation in the type of cancer? Well, pending approval, I am very comfortable considering subcutaneous administration of nivolumab across different disease states. As an example, earlier line setting, frontline setting in a patient that could have received nivolumab, ipilimumab, and then move on to nivolumab maintenance for clear cell RCC, matching, of course, the FDA and EMA approval, I would be very comfortable to offer the administration of nivolumab subcutaneous in a maintenance strategy. But pushing that idea even further, I would be discussing that in the adjuvant space. So not in RCC where nivolumab is not approved, but let's talk about a patient with muscle-invasive bladder carcinoma. Is that something I would like to discuss with my patient? Let's take the idea of a 49-year-old female patient, excellent health status, that had hematuria, was treated for muscle-invasive bladder carcinoma, received a neoadjuvant chemotherapy, then surgery, and then is considered for adjuvant therapy, PD-L1 positive. This patient does match what are the usual criteria of nivolumab adjuvant used based on a benefit in disease-free survival. And here I'm depicting what the CheckMate 274 study has highlighted, the ability of nivolumab to demonstrate benefit over placebo in preventing disease recurrence. And this is extremely true, as you may be familiar with, in PD-L1 positive subset of patients. So based on the results of this study, nivolumab was granted FDA approval for the adjuvant treatment of those patients at a high risk of recurrence. And so the question is, in such a patient who is matching the criteria for nivolumab use, would I be in favor of offering subcutaneous administration of nivolumab? And the answer is yes, and it's not only the case with nivolumab. There are other studies ongoing asking exactly the same question. And here is a phase 3 named CREST. We're not exactly in the same setting. This is a non-muscle invasive bladder carcinoma, and the drug is another one. This is sasanlimab. This study is fully accrued. Look at the numbers. These are a large number of patients, over 1,000 patients. But here again, the question is, can sasanlimab be used with the subcutaneous administration? And so we'll be using this data, hopefully in the future, to confirm what I'm discussing with you today. There are other tumor types that are still under investigation, and I'm going to draw your attention to the question of pembrolizumab use. And this is a study in non-small cell lung cancer. This study is addressing the question of subcutaneous pembro plus platinum doublet chemotherapy versus IV pembro plus platinum doublet chemotherapy. And here again, the co-primary endpoint are PK-driven, but the bottom line is response rate to make sure that not only your patient is well exposed, but that you're also matching your clinical endpoints that you expect in this setting. So this study is still ongoing, well, still pending results, but there are other tumor types. And I'm going to walk you now to melanoma. What we know in melanoma is that relatlimab has demonstrated the benefit over, in combination with nivolumab, over nivolumab. The reason why I'm bringing that now is that even in this setting, subcutaneous administration is being considered. And this is a phase 3. Here again, looking at PK endpoint with secondary endpoint of response rate, randomizing over 500 patients with melanoma between subcutaneous nivolumab plus relatlimab plus our RHU PH20 versus IV nivolumab plus relatlimab. So it's not only single agent that is being considered as subcutaneous administration, but also combination of a checkpoint inhibitor. And I think this is very important because this is how the field is moving forward. different tumor types, different disease setting, adjuvant, even non-muscle invasive bladder carcinoma, for instance. And here, combination strategy. So all across the different indication, the question of moving to sub-Q is driving us so that we can expand the management and the quality of life for our patient. So this means that we will have to rethink our team's organization. We need to work all together to explain what are these approach and to make sure that they are properly managed. We'll have a role among medical oncologists, urologists, for instance, in the bladder carcinoma field, but also nurse that will be involved on how we handle those administration. They will be performed initially in the hospital, but we could also think a few years ahead and think about more local administration. So I want to summarize a bit the pros and cons of IV versus sub-Q. What we've been doing until now was IV administration. We know it's rapid absorption. It is well established. Patients can be managed promptly. You can discontinue your infusion, for instance. But IV requires infusion centers. It has a cost, including the time in the hospital, the nurse costs, and so on. And it requires the patient to move to the facilities where the IV will be administered. Now, thinking about sub-Q, my personal feeling is that the administration is easier, that ultimately this can be done not only in clinic, but maybe in a few years' time, even at home. That will require specific analysis in terms of feasibility and pathways, but this is something we should have in mind. I clearly believe that this will save time both for the patient and for nurse staff. And there are cons that are currently being listed. Among them would be the question of the patient cost and what will be the cost of these agents being administered subcutaneously. And hopefully, we can push and lobby for this to be affordable. I wouldn't say that the absorption is unreliable. What I've shown you today is clearly that the PK endpoints across different studies are clearly met, as well as clinical endpoints. And so I would clearly push back around this con. And with regard to hypersensitivity, at least for now, patient will be clearly monitored within your hospital with your nurse who will be administering the sub-Q drug. And I believe that hypersensitivity will be addressed as fast as it is done with your IV administration. So in summary, I believe that we've seen evidence that supports the great impact of sub-Q checkpoint inhibitors use across multiple tumor types. And I believe that we've learned how effective this approach can be so that we can do a better job in terms of patient time, patient quality of life, and optimization of our health system. I would like also to remind you that you can download the practice aids associated with this educational activity as a resource for you, your staff, and your patients. And obviously, this content is going to grow over time as we're waiting for further study to mature. And I will finish by thanking you all for joining us today. I hope you found this activity informative. I think we are really changing the game here in new organization. These are updates that are important for our patients and important for our healthcare system. And I hope it will be useful for all of you in your practice. Thank you very much for your attention.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/GUE860. This activity is supported through an educational grant from Bristol-Myers Squibb.